From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how did presidential campaign ads become so important? We'll listen back to the most significant TV campaign ads dating back to the first presidential campaign that used them, Eisenhower versus Stevenson in 1952. And we'll talk with David Schwartz, who co-curated an internet exhibition of campaign ads for the American Museum of the Moving Image. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews a documentary about White House reporter Helen Thomas that premieres tonight on HBO. And we'll listen back to our 1993 interview with record producer Jerry Wexler. He died Friday at the age of 91. He produced hits for Atlantic Records by Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Wilson Pickett, and the Drifters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In anticipation of the Democratic and Republican conventions, this week we're featuring interviews about presidential history and politics. The Obama and McCain campaigns are spending a fortune on TV ads that are analyzed on talk shows and news shows. How did TV ads become so important? We're going to listen back to some of the most influential campaign ads, starting with the first campaign that used them, Eisenhower versus Stevenson in 1952. You don't hear jingles like this anymore.
Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president. You like Ike, I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike
for president.
Hang out the banner, beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington.
We don't want John
or Dean
or Harry.
Let's do that big job right. Just get in step with the guy that's hep. Get in step with Ike. You like Ike.
That ad is included in an internet exhibit about the history of TV presidential campaign ads called The Living Room Candidate. It was launched by the American Museum of the Moving Image in New York during the 2004 presidential campaign. It collects over 250 ads from every election between 1952 and 2004. The exhibition is still online at livingroomcandidate.org and will be updated in September. David Schwartz is the museum's curator of film and is the co-curator of The Living Room Candidate. I spoke with him in 2004. Whose idea was it to do a campaign ad in the Eisenhower, campaign crew?
It was Madison Avenue's idea. There was an advertising man named Russet Reeves, his earlier claim to fame was the M&M melts in your mouth, not in your hands campaign. And it was really his strategy to produce these 20-second ads. He thought they would be very effective. He thought they could reach a lot of people. The Stevenson campaign made a very interesting choice, and it was a big mistake that year with their TV strategy. They purchased half-hour time slots, a series of 18 time slots between 10:30 and 11 o'clock at night, where Stevenson would go on the air and do speeches, half-hour speeches. Now, it sounded like a good idea at the time, and he was a very good speaker, had great oratorical skills. The problem was that the only people who were really tuning in to watch these half-hour speeches were people who already were going to vote for Stevenson. The strategy with the Eisenhower spot ads was they could go on to popular TV shows like I Love Lucy and catch a captive audience that was already there.
Let's listen to another Eisenhower ad, also from 1952, in which a woman expresses her concern about high prices. Before we actually hear this ad, set it up for us. What's happening visually?
Each of these ads, this is the Eisenhower Answers America spot, consists of two shots. The first shot in the ad, and I think of these commercials as short movies, and this is a very short movie. You see an ordinary person, in this case, a woman is concerned about the high cost of living, high prices. And they ask a question of Eisenhower. And the person who's asking the question is filmed from above, the camera sort of looking down at them. And then we cut to Eisenhower. And in those shots, the camera is looking up at Eisenhower, so he looks kind of heroic. And he answers the question of the ordinary person. So he's connecting with the voter.
Okay, so here we are, an ad for the Eisenhower campaign in 1952.
Eisenhower Answers America.
You know what things cost today. High prices are just driving me crazy.
Yes, my mamie gets after me about the high cost of living. It's another reason why I say it's time for a change. Time to get back to an honest dollar and an honest dollar's worth.
A couple of things I find really interesting about that 1952 mm-hmm. Eisenhower ad. One is that they both absolutely sound like they're reading the script for the first time. They're not very good at acting the part of being themselves.
No. Well, they filmed about 40 of these commercials in one day. They basically took Eisenhower into a studio in Midtown Manhattan and set him up in front of a bunch of gigantic cue cards where they had the scripts. And Eisenhower was a little bit uncomfortable doing this. At one point, probably about halfway through the session, he said, "It's kind of a shame that an old soldier should have to come to this." And he was just reading these answers off of big cue cards. And he was a little bit stiff, perhaps, but probably not as stiff as Stevenson came across in his TV appearances. But the commercials look kind of crude. Eisenhower's answers were filmed separately from these ordinary people who were rounded up in front of Radio City Music Hall and brought in after Eisenhower's answers were filmed. Ordinary people were brought in to ask their questions.
So was this, quote, ordinary people ad effective?
It's hard to say if this ad was determinative in the election. Eisenhower would have won this election almost under any circumstances. It was a landslide election. But I think it was effective because the Eisenhower campaign spent about $1 million putting their ads on TV, or actually close to $2 million. The Stevenson campaign only spent about $77,000 in TV ads that year. In 1956, when there was a rematch of Eisenhower versus Stevenson, Stevenson decided to do his own series of ads called The Man from Libertyville, and he appeared on television. So after 1952, it was evident that candidates would have to do these commercials and style themselves as TV stars, even though they were reluctant, even though Stevenson and Eisenhower both were kind of reluctant to become TV actors, they realized they had to do it.
Now, John F. Kennedy was very telegenic. Mm. What were his TV ads like?
John Kennedy's TV ads really reflected the spontaneity and freshness of his campaign. He was great on television. Of course, it's very well known that he looked much better than Richard Nixon in the debates. He was a lot fresher and more spontaneous. And the spontaneity of the campaign was captured by documentary film cameras. At the time, in 1960, filmmakers were starting to use lightweight portable cameras. And often, Kennedy's campaign appearances were filmed. Cameras would follow him follow him around making speeches, follow him into people's living rooms. There's one ad that we have on our site, which is Kennedy in an ordinary living room talking to average voters. It's really the personality and freshness of the Kennedy campaign came across in his TV ads.
This is the Sills family. Recently, John F. Kennedy visited the Sills.
Mr. and Mrs. Sills are facing one of the great problems that all American families are now facing, and that is the great increase in the cost of living.
Our rent has gone up, our food, our cleaning of our clothing, buying of the clothing, our gas and electric, and our telephone bills have gone up.
What's been your experience, Mrs. Sills, as far as keeping those two daughters of yours going?
We're very concerned with their future. We would like both of them to go to college.
Have you been able to put much aside as far as...
Unfortunately, not right now.
One of the things which I think has increased the cost of living has been this administration's reliance upon a high interest rate policy. My own judgment is that we're going to have to try to do a better job in this field.
Yes, we can do better. But to do so, we must elect the man who cares about America's problems. We must elect John F. Kennedy, president.
That's a TV ad from John Kennedy's campaign in 1960. Let's skip ahead to a 1964 ad from the Johnson campaign against Barry Goldwater. Now, it's very famous, but it was only run once as a paid political ad. Would you describe what's happening visually in this ad, and then we'll play the audio?
The visuals are, again, two very simple shots that are juxtaposed. The ad starts off with an image of a young girl who looks like she's 5 or 6 years old, and she's in a field picking petals off of a daisy and counting up to 10. And that's the first shot. And as she approaches 10, the camera zooming in, and it closes in on her eye. And then we start to hear an ominous voice, a countdown to a nuclear explosion. And the ad actually ends with an image of a huge mushroom cloud and a nuclear explosion.
Okay, let's hear the audio from this 1964 ad by the LBJ campaign.
Stakes to make a world in which all of God's children can live or to go into the dark. We must either love each other or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
It's probably the first and the last time that nuclear apocalypse was used in a campaign ad. Why was this ad taken off the air after one run?
Well, this was a very effective ad because it really played on the fear that Barry Goldwater could get us into a nuclear war. Now, supposedly, Johnson was reluctant to run this ad. It was pretty over the top in a way because what it was saying was that if you vote for Barry Goldwater, the world could come to an end. I mean, that's pretty extreme even for an attack ad. And it was controversial. As soon as the ad aired, it was shown during a movie of the week broadcast of the movie David and Bathsheba. As soon as it aired, the switchboards lit up at the White House and also at the network, and there were a lot of complaints from the Goldwater campaign that this ad was just unfair. Now, what's interesting is that Barry Goldwater's name is never even mentioned in the ad, but the public really knew that he had made some extreme statements at the convention that year. He said that extremism and the defense of liberty is no vice, and he had advocated the possible use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam, tactical nuclear weapons. So this ad really played into that fear. But the Johnson campaign tried this ad out, and they had a lot of other attack ads that they had also made. But what happened was the ad instantly went from a paid advertisement to a major news story. So as soon as the Goldwater campaign complained about it, the network news broadcast started replaying the ad and talking about it. And so the Johnson campaign didn't have to pay for it anymore to be on the air. It became a news story.
My guest is David Schwartz. He co-curated the internet exhibition of presidential campaign ads for the American Museum of the Moving Image. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Schwartz. He co-curated an internet exhibit of presidential TV campaign ads for the American Museum of the Moving Image. Let's move on to an ad from 1980 for the Reagan campaign against the incumbent Jimmy Carter. And I was really surprised to see this ad. I don't remember this one from television, but it's an ad featuring Nancy Reagan sitting in a chair and talking. Describe what's happening visually in this ad, and then we'll play it.
Well, we see Nancy Reagan. She's dressed in red. She looks like a conventional image of a candidate's spouse, a potential first lady in this case, and she's just talking directly to the camera. So we seem to be being set up for a sort of upbeat, positive ad where we're going to hear from the candidate's wife, maybe about how great her husband is.
Okay, here's Nancy Reagan in 1980.
I deeply, deeply resent and am offended by the attacks that President Carter has made on my husband, the personal attacks that he's made on my husband, his attempt to paint my husband as a man he is not. He is not a warmonger. He is not a man who is going to throw the elderly out on the street and cut out their Social Security. That's a terrible thing to do and to say about anybody. That's campaigning on fear. There are many issues that are at stake in this campaign. I would like Mr. Carter to explain to me why the inflation is as high as it is, why unemployment is as high as it is. I would like to have him explain the vacillating, weak foreign policy so that our friends overseas don't know what we're going to do, whether we're going to stand up for them or whether we're not going to stand up for them. And the issue of this campaign is his 3.5-year record.
The time is now for strong leadership.
It's Nancy Reagan in 1980, a campaign ad for her husband. Did she have to be convinced to do this ad, do you know?
Oh, I don't know. I think that Nancy Reagan was quite happy to be an attack dog for her husband. She was very strong and outspoken. And the idea of the 1980 campaign was to let other people do the dirty work and have Reagan come across as a nice guy, you know, saying, there you go again in the debate to Jimmy Carter, being affable. So I think Nancy was quite happy to do some of the dirty work in this ad.
Was this ad effective, do you know?
I think this is a very effective ad because it does a really neat trick. It starts off as a defense of her husband. It's Nancy defending her husband from attack. And then halfway through the ad, she turns it around and she goes on the attack against Jimmy Carter. And she's lecturing him. She's saying, you know, I want Jimmy Carter to answer to me. I mean, that's a pretty amazing way to talk to the president of the United States. And I think some of the best politicians, the real masters of the form, know how to sort of start off seeming nice and then go on the attack. And the whole 1980 campaign, the Reagan campaign against Carter, really had to attack Jimmy Carter as president. You know, when you have an incumbent president, you really have to convince the country that they've done a bad job or that they should be replaced. So I think this ad really, really did that trick.
Now, the most famous political campaign of the Reagan era was the Morning in America ad, which is, I think it's fair to say, one of the more famous political ads in political ad history. This was in the 1984 re-election campaign. Again, I'm going to ask you to describe what's happening visually before we hear it.
Basically, we're seeing a montage of images. It's almost like a moving Norman Rockwell painting. We're seeing a sort of white picket fence series of shots of people in a small suburban town going about their business. It's very upbeat and positive. We don't see Ronald Reagan in the ad, and if you're just watching the ad, it could be for almost anything. It could be an ad for an insurance company, a beverage, any kind of product. It's an upbeat, positive-looking, idealized view of America.
Okay, let's hear it now, and this is the Morning in America ad for the Reagan campaign in 1984.
It's morning again in America. Today, more men and women will go to work than ever before in our country's history. With interest rates at about half the record highs of 1980, nearly 2,000 families today will buy new homes, more than at any time in the past 4 years. This afternoon, 6,500 young men and women will be married. And with inflation at less than half of what it was just 4 years ago, they can look forward with confidence to the future. It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better. Why would we ever want to return to where we were less than 4 short years ago?
It's the Reagan campaign 1984 Morning in America ad. 4 years after the Reagan ad that we just heard, Michael Dukakis took out an ad saying that he had it with George H.W. Bush's misleading ads. What was Dukakis reacting against?
Dukakis was reacting against a number of really strong attack ads. The 1988 campaign was very, very nasty. The Bush campaign that year was headed by Roger Ailes. And Dukakis was in very solid shape after the Democratic convention, about 17 points up in the polls. And the ads were just very, very strong. It was a classic campaign where the Republicans tried to paint the Democrat as a weak Massachusetts liberal. And there was one ad in particular that really got Dukakis upset, where he was, they used a photo opportunity where Dukakis was riding around in a tank, in a military helmet. I mean, everybody can visualize this ad, I think, because it's been replayed so many times. And the ad ridiculed the idea of Dukakis as commander-in-chief and said that he was going to cut all these important defense programs. Factually, the ad was untrue. I mean, it was making claims that were just plain not true. But what was really effective was this image of Dukakis in a tank and the idea that he would look kind of silly as commander-in-chief.
So let's listen to this 1988 Dukakis ad. And again, before we do, I'm going to ask you to describe what we would be seeing if we were, in fact, watching it.
What we're going to be seeing is an angry Michael Dukakis turning off the TV set after having watched a Bush attack ad against him. And he's in a white shirt, sort of the Harry Truman look, you know, plain speaking, tough guy, tough, angry Democrat, and he's talking directly to the camera, directly to the voter.
Okay, let's hear it in 1988.
I'm fed up with it. Never seen anything like it in 25 years of public life, George Bush's negative TV ads, distorting my record, full of lies, and he knows it. I'm on the record for the very weapon systems his ads say I'm against. I want to build a strong defense. I'm sure he wants to build a strong defense. So this isn't about defense issues. It's about dragging the truth into the gutter. And I'm not going to let them do it. This campaign is too important. The stakes are too high for every American family. The real question is, will we have a president who fights for the privileged few, or will we have a president who fights for you? George Bush wants to give the wealthiest 1% of the people in this country a new tax break worth $30,000 a year. I'm fighting for you and your family, for affordable housing and health care, for better jobs, for the best education and opportunity for our children. It's a tough fight. I know that. Uphill all the way. But I'm going to keep on fighting, because what I'm fighting for is our future.
A Michael Dukakis campaign ad in 1988. Well, this is a very literal counterattack. I mean, he's watching the TV with the ad against him. He turns it off, says to the audience, this is misleading. They're misrepresenting me. How do you think it played? Do you have any idea if it registered on the American public?
Well, what's really interesting about this ad is that Dukakis had been criticized earlier in the campaign for not responding to attacks. He was being attacked every day by the Bush campaign, and he wasn't fighting back. And then he decided to fight back. And I think the problem with fighting back and being so direct in your response is that you can start to look defensive. And one of the real interesting things when you look at the ads from 1952 to the present is there are some very basic strategies that are used over and over again. The Republicans love to say that they're strong on military and that if you vote for the Democrat, they're going to cut our defense system and they'll be weak. And they love to say that that they're going to cut your taxes. The Democrats love to say, we're going to fight for the average person. And that's what you hear in this ad.
Well, David Schwartz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure.
David Schwartz co-curated an internet exhibit of presidential TV campaign ads for the American Museum of the Moving Image. You can find it at livingroomcandidate.org. The exhibit will be updated in September. Our interview was recorded in 2004. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Jerry Wexler produced groundbreaking R&B records by Ray Charles, The Drifters, Wilson Pickett, and Aretha Franklin. He died Friday at the age of 91. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with Jerry Wexler. And David Bianculli reviews a new HBO documentary about White House correspondent Helen Thomas. It premieres tonight. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of the greatest soul and rhythm and blues recordings wouldn't have been made if it weren't for Jerry Wexler. Wexler died Friday at the age of 91. He was a partner in Atlantic Records from the early 1950s through the mid-70s. His specialty was finding great singers and matching them with the right band and backup singers to create a sound that was both artistically true and commercially successful. The short list of people he worked with includes the Drifters, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, Etta James, and Solomon Burke. Here's just a few of the records we have Jerry Wexler to thank for.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. You see the girl with the diamond ring? She knows how to shake that thing. All right, now, now. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love comes tumbling down. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour when there's no one else around.
Under the boardwalk,
out of the sun.
Under the boardwalk,
we'll be having some fun.
Under the boardwalk,
people walking above.
Under the boardwalk,
making love
under the boardwalk,
boardwalk.
I spoke with Jerry Wexler in 1993, after the publication of his memoir, Rhythm and the Blues. It was a live interview at the Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C., in front of an audience of public radio program directors, managers, and producers.
I want to get started with your work with Aretha Franklin. I think that's a good place to start. Now, she had made about, 10 or so recordings on Columbia Records before coming to Atlantic. John Hammond produced her, and he was producing her like a jazz singer, kind of in the Dinah Washington tradition. Yeah. You, when she came to Atlantic, you worked with her. You heard something completely different. What did you hear when you started producing her?
Well, I heard the Aretha Franklin who sang in church, who sang Precious Lord when she was 13 years old, and a man in the audience was so overcome, he said, listen at her, listen at her. And I listened, and it wasn't so much that I tried a new approach to her. It's that what she did fit very well in with what we were doing anyhow.
Well, you sat her down at the piano.
Right.
You had her play herself, which I don't think she'd done on the records before that.
Not very much.
What was it like at Muscle Shoals? What did you hear there in that southern sound that you wanted?
Well, it was the way they recorded, which was ad-lib recording without written arrangements, building the song from the get-go, just from the chords. And the musicians made a fabulous contribution. So these were arrangements which we all did together. And they were just as much arrangements as anything that was ever done by Henry Mancini, in the sense of being an arranged piece of music.
So you took Aretha down to Muscle Shoals, recorded like a track and a half with her, and there was this really big fight. What was the fight about?
There was an explosion that went on because of too much Jack Daniels and not enough Prudence. And it had to do with Ted White, who was Aretha's husband at the time, who got it into a dangerous, over-friendly drinking from the same jug with a gentleman who can best be described as a card-carrying redneck, trumpet player. And it got into what we call the dozens, the Southern Dozens, and then it got nasty. And the session blew up, and we went back to New York with one song complete, which was I Never Loved a Man, and a three-piece track on the other side, which was Do Right Woman. And all we had there was rhythm guitar, bass, and drums, which is not a whole lot to go on.
Not even vocal?
No vocal, no piano, no background vocal. And then we finished by bringing Aretha and her sisters into the studio. And it was a pretty good piece of extemporization in that, starting with this very minimal track, Aretha laid down an organ part and a piano part. And then she sang the lead, and then she and her sisters got together and did the background. And it was a very full, finished record put together, well, I'd say, with spit and chewing gum.
You produced Respect. Is there a story behind how the Sakatumis landed on there?
Well, this, yeah, the story is that when Otis Redding did it, it was entirely a different song. The Sakatumis were Aretha Franklin's idea, where she injected into the song, which connoted a certain idea of social respect, probably the notion of ethnic respect, combined with a little judicious lubricity on her part. The respect that she was talking about was what you might call, very bluntly call, proper sexual attention. But it was her transmutation of Otis Redding's little Southern song. As a matter of fact, I was mixing the record in our studio on Broadway, and Otis walked in. He said, "That little gal done took my song."
Now, your first studio was actually the office.
That's right.
Of Atlantic Records. Who did right. you? Because when Atlantic was young, you didn't have a studio. So what did you do? You'd move out the chairs into the hallway whenever you wanted to record?
We did have a studio. It was our office, and it was a studio because we had equipment in it. And my partner, Ahmed Erdogan, and I shared this big room. We had two desks that were catty-cornered, canted toward each other. And what we would do is push them against the wall, stack them, and then our engineer, Tom Dowd, would set out camp chairs, a few microphones, and one mic in the hall for echo.
Now, you work with Otis Redding a lot during his career.
I was not Otis's producer. I want you to realize that. Otis was produced at Stax Records in Memphis by that great team of Jim Stewart and Booker T and the MGs, especially Steve Cropper.
Now, you saw him change a lot as he became better
known.
What was he like in the beginning before he was very famous? What was he
Otis
like on stage?
Otis was very simple, very unaffected, but he had the magic. And when he came to New York after his first hit record, I picked him up at the airport. No roadies, nobody, no nothing, just sole Otis. And he opened at the Apollo, and he just stood there, just straight on, with his arms at his side, didn't move. Another one who started like that was Marvin Gaye. But they learned some stagecraft, but what really kicked Otis into moving was having to follow Sam and Dave, who used to be described as a stage full of Jackie Wilsons.
That's really great. No, you know, we were talking before how you brought Aretha Franklin down to Muscle Shoals, Alabama. You brought Wilson Pickett down to Memphis to record.
Right.
You really loved that Southern sound that was coming out of some of the bands there. Why did you think of bringing him there?
Well, because everything was winding down in New York. I mean, it was entropy. We just couldn't get out of our own way. We had been very successful year after year, but our style of recording was a regular old-time standard style, using arrangers with written arrangements. Now, when you have to change an arrangement, and you almost always do, to accommodate the vicissitudes of the song and where you're going, it's total agony for the entrepreneur to see that clock going around while a man is going around with an eraser, erasing little notes on 13 charts. And this Southern style of recording, where it's just all you have is chord indications. You go out, you sing a lick, do it like this, fellas. Bang, here's the new chord, you know. But maybe that's overstating it, but actually there's a spontaneity and a fantastic new element that comes in because the musicians are organic to the idea.
We're listening back to a 1993 interview with Jerry Wexler. He died Friday at the age of 91. Here's a Wilson Pickett track that Wexler produced in 1966.
Baby, I'll be right here.
We'll hear more of our 1993 interview with record producer Jerry Wexler after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1993 interview with Jerry Wexler. He produced many great R&B records for Atlantic Records by Ray Charles, The Drifters, Wilson Pickett, Solomon Burke, and Aretha Franklin. Wexler died Friday at the age of 91. There's so much that a record producer is up against, often the real unexpected, and I think a great example of that is when you were producing The Drifters' version of Under the Boardwalk. Let's start with the beginning of that story. First of all, they didn't want to even record the song.
That's right.
You gave them an ultimatum.
Right. I was not the line producer of that song. I was acting as a supervisor, you know, as an executive of the company, and The Drifters were always a concern of mine. And a great producer, deceased Bert Burns, was producing the record, and neither he nor any of the Drifters could stand the song. They just couldn't buy it. And I didn't want to interfere because Bert was the producer, but this sounds like a very self-congratulatory. And I said, this song has to be done. And I said, you can pick all the rest. I said, or else ain't no session.
Why did you like the song so much?
Because it sounded like a hit.
Okay, good enough reason. Okay, so what happened to the lead singer the night before the session?
The lead singer at the time was a man named Rudy Lewis. You know, we had three fantastic lead singers in the Drifters. The first was Clyde McFadden. The second was Rudy Lewis. His name is not as well known, but he did some great songs. And the third was Benny King, who's having a great resurgence with Stand By Me. I mean, you can't turn around without hearing it anymore. But Rudy Lewis, unfortunately, the night before the session, was found dead in the hotel room with a hypodermic needle in his arm. And the night before the session. And we tried to call off the session, but it was a big date, and we had hired a lot of union musicians, and the union wasn't cutting us any slack at all. They gave us 24 hours. So we moved the session ahead one more day. But then we couldn't even change the charts, so we had to use Johnny Moore to sing the lead, and without even the key change, and he managed to sing it in the key that was put to him. And the interesting thing about the record was we promoted it all along the Eastern Seaboard and Atlantic City and so on, and it evoked summer all the time.
And you actually did a lot of that yourself, didn't you? You packed up the car and drove around promoting the record
because
you wanted it to break so bad.
That's right, and we did a lot of that in those days.
I really want you to talk a little bit about the early days of getting black music played on white radio stations, and you were doing promotion as well as production at Atlantic Records back in the 50s and the early 60s when radio was still pretty segregated. And I'd like to hear a little bit about what it was like to get white DJs to play the rhythm and blues recordings that you were producing then.
Heavy agita. You just couldn't do it. I mean, you couldn't, except for white disc jockeys on black stations. This was an odd phenomenon. The leading disc jockeys on rhythm and blues stations were Caucasians who, without being mimetic, they managed to sound black, and the audiences accepted them as black. I'm talking about people like Zena Sears from New Jersey, Hunter Hancock from L.A., Huggy Boy from L.A., of course, Alan Freed, who came along, and of course, he got so big that he couldn't disguise his racial identity anymore. So it was very difficult, and this was not due to racist attitudes on the part of the PDs or the musical directors. It had to do with the advertisers. This black music did not fit with the demographics. It was simple as that. So it was no use ranting and raving. It was part of the socioeconomics of the era. The music, it would be like playing mazurkas, you know, on a classical station. It just didn't go.
Back in those days, too, to get a record played, you had to pay for, more or less, to pay for consideration, as you put it.
Absolutely. It was a subterranean advertising, let's say. These people were badly underpaid. Of course, I'm sure that hasn't changed. I'm sure that's changed a lot. And the guy and the guy at the mic is just rolling in the, fantastic emoluments.
So what were some of the things you would do for the disc jockeys?
A nylon sweater, bottle of Jim Beam, until it got real competitive, and then we got into the hundreds per month.
Right.
Yeah. Another thing is that what you would do is that you'd bring your artist there, and he could have a stage show or a concert and be the entrepreneur, and he'd get them for a very low price, like zilch, sometimes nothing. And you paid your dues to get these, and we were glad to do it.
One of the great things about this book is that there's all kinds of like fights between legendary people that are out. There's a when you got the call that Aretha Franklin was ready to sign with Atlantic Records, there was a wonderful fight.
All right.
Happening in the studio between Wilson Pickett and Percy Sledge?
Percy Sledge. Percy Sledge is also a native of Muscle Shoals. He came from Alabama, and very genial, sweet man. And I was working on a vocal with Wilson Pickett, and Percy comes into the control room, and he said, "Wilson, that was great, man. You sound just like Otis." I mean, the red neck came up, and Wilson bristled, and I got Percy out, and I said, "Percy, later." Well, he comes ambling back in about 3 hours later. He said, "Man, that was a hell of a lick. That was just like James." That's the worst thing he could have said, because James Brown and Wilson Pickett have had a century-old falling out about a chick, And he couldn't have done worse. And Wilson went for Percy like that. I got in the way, and I probably went about 180 pounds, and he just flicked me like that, and I went to the wall. Because I used to call Wilson the Black Panther before there was a Black Panther movement, because he was, there was, the ideal metaphor for Wilson, because he was sleek, he was beautiful, and he was like a baling wire and nuts and bolts. And he was terrific. A beautiful man, but a man who had definite ideas about his own whims.
So you got the call from Aretha in the middle of this fight?
In the middle
after
of that,
you were slammed against the wall?
I bounced off okay. And I got a call from a woman named Louise Bishop, who is still, I think, pretty well known in Philadelphia, working under the name of Louise Williams, gospel disc jockey, a friend of mine. And in those days, Aretha's circle was the gospel wheel. That's right. Who she hung out with. This was before, the big secular explosion. And Louise was a pal of hers. And Louise, a pal of mine, had sort of been hawking her on my account. And she said, "Here's the number. Aretha's ready." And like the fella said, you never look back,
Jerry Wexler recorded in front of a live audience at the Public Radio Conference in 1993. Wexler died Friday at the age of 91. Here's one of the great Aretha Franklin records he produced.
Baby, baby, sweet baby.
Coming up, David Bianculli reviews a new HBO documentary about journalist Helen Thomas, who has covered 9 presidents. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Helen Thomas has been a member of the White House Press Corps since 1961 and has covered every U.S. president since John F. Kennedy. Under the current administration, she's persona non grata in the briefing room and has shifted from reporter to columnist and author. Tonight, she's the subject of a documentary profile on HBO, a profile produced and directed by Rory Kennedy, the youngest child of Robert F. Kennedy. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
This new HBO profile of former United Press International Wire reporter Helen Thomas has a lot of neat angles to it. It's produced and directed by Rory Kennedy, whose uncle, John F. Kennedy, was the first president Thomas covered as a reporter for UPI. And in this documentary, called Thank You, Mr. President, Helen Thomas at the White House, the woman who covered nine presidents doesn't ask questions, she answers them. Thank You, Mr. President is a great subject for a documentary, and it's telling that it's presented by HBO rather than one of the broadcast networks. Maybe the networks just felt too close to the subject or didn't want to offend the White House. It's just as likely, though, that it's because Helen Thomas in this documentary is just like Helen Thomas in the White House briefing room, brazenly outspoken. One segment of Thank You, Mr. President illustrates this perfectly. It begins with Thomas appearing on CNN, interviewed by Wolf Blitzer, about her very unflattering quoted remark about President George W. Bush. Then it shifts to Thomas at the daily White House press briefing, jousting with Press Secretary Dana Perino about civilian casualties in Iraq, an exchange that is repeated, then ridiculed, by Bill O'Reilly. And finally, to finish the segment, Rory Kennedy asks Thomas about the liberal media, and sparks another unvarnished exchange.
You said, this is the worst president ever. He is the worst president in all of American history.
I never said that on the record, but it certainly got out.
It got out.
Yes. I think that that there's a room for improvement.
On the Pinhead front, far-left Washington correspondent Helen Thomas put forth that the American military is targeting civilians in Iraq, and got scolded for it.
Helen, I find it really unfortunate that you use your front row position bestowed upon you by your colleagues to make such statements. It is an honor and a privilege to be in the briefing room, and to suggest that we at the United States are killing innocent people is just absurd and very offensive.
Do you know how many we have since the start of the war?
How many? We are going after the enemy, Helen. To the extent that any innocent Iraqis have been killed, we have expressed regret for it.
Well, regret, it doesn't bring back a life.
Pinhead label for Helen Thomas? I think so.
Do you think there's a liberal bias in the press?
Hell no. I want to find one fellow liberal. I'm dying to find another liberal. Open their mouths. Where are they?
This documentary covers a lot of ground, almost too quickly. It's more like a greatest hits overview than an in-depth deconstruction. But we do learn a lot of interesting facts about Helen Thomas herself. How her parents, who emigrated from Syria in the 1890s, could neither read nor write. How Helen, as a teenager, got hooked on journalism by getting her first byline in a high school newspaper. And how, on an appearance on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, she is honest and objective enough to say regarding the entire White House press corps, all presidents hate us. Under questioning by Rory Kennedy, Helen Thomas apologizes for the way she and her White House colleagues reported Watergate, because it took Washington Post reporters Woodward and Bernstein, whom she calls outsiders, to break the story. But while she expresses dismay that Bill Clinton had to answer so many mortifyingly personal questions during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, she doesn't apologize for asking them. You had to write it, she says of that story. Vintage news clips give us a taste of the reporter's close proximity to presidents and history, and also touches on other issues. For example, how the role of women in the press corps has changed over the decades, and how reporting itself has changed over that same period. Not just technologically, but attitudinally. What's missing from Thank You, Mr. President are other voices. No former presidents or fellow reporters are asked about Thomas, and no presidential historians or media critics are asked to put her in perspective. Also, oddly, there's no mention of or questions about the man known as Jeff Gannon, the right-wing blogger and fake correspondent given access for years by the Bush White House. Clearly, there's a bigger and better documentary waiting to be made here, one about the history of the White House press corps itself, one that would cover not only Helen Thomas and Jeff Gannon, but Sam Donaldson and Dan Rather. But for now, we have Thank You, Mr. President. It's a good place to start. But like so many narratives involving the White House, there's a lot more digging to do and a lot more story to tell.
David Bianculli writes about television for TVWorthWatching.com and Broadcasting and Cable Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to protect the environment through its mining campaign at pewtrusts.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from Delacourt Press, publisher of Fractured, a police procedural thriller set in the heart of Atlanta by Karen Slaughter, author of Beyond Reach. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our week of interviews on presidential politics. Presidential historian Michael Beschloss talks about and plays tapes secretly recorded in the White House by President Johnson. And Mort Saul talks about creating comedy based on headlines, not one-liners. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.